Welcome, welcome. It's that time of the week again. It's Thursday evening. You're listening to the Orchard Business Show. I'm David Zeidel, and with us this evening, we've got Michael Abramson. He's a sports commentator, mentalist, a radio show host, and a qualified actuary. Good evening, Michael.
Hi, David. Thanks so much for the invitation. Great to chat to you.
Yeah, it's great that you're with us. So Michael is someone who, if you listen to his voice, you must probably know who it is, but you don't know from where. He is truly someone who defines a jack of all trades. With a career spanning over 36 years in broadcasting, he's one of South Africa's most celebrated sports presenters and commentators. A recipient of 17 major awards and the host of the award-winning show Top Sport on SAFM. But this is just one side of his remarkable story. Known to many as a power brain, our guest holds 3 world records for recalling digits of pi. And when he does that, he's actually blindfolded. Those who don't know what pi is, it's 3.14, and that's all I can say. But Michael has achieved the world record of doing this. He recalled in 2025 200 digits while being blindfolded in 30 seconds, just over 30 seconds. That is 6.5 digits per second, and he did it without error. And in 2022, he recalled 2,000 digits blindfolded and did that in just over 5 minutes. He's also South Africa's dedicated educator who has spent nearly 3 decades teaching memory and study skills to thousands of students. So whether he's commentating on World Cup finals, as he's doing at the moment, performing interactive mentalism on luxury cruise ships, or even winning the popular music game show Noot for Noot in a different language, it's quite amazing. Noot for Noot is in Afrikaans, and he won it by remembering all the different songs. He brings an incredible depth of knowledge and versatility to everything he does. So what we're going to do is try and unpack this amazing mind to find out who Michael really is and how did he get to where he is. But Michael, before we get to you, I always share a short little business story. And the story that I'm sharing tonight is chapter 12. So I'm going through my book of the 18 Steps to Success and some of the lessons that were learned through running. And it's from the book Life on the Run. And chapter 12 talks about enjoy what you're doing as you do it. And it's about you will always be more successful if you're doing something that you've got a passion about. And 2 people will have a look at a certain field, and if the field is empty, the one will say, well, nothing's growing here. It doesn't work. And someone will say, nothing's growing yet, and it's fertile ground. And so it's not just what exists, it's the way that you look at it that gives you the opportunity of making it work. And Jim Rohn said, success is doing ordinary things, but doing them extraordinary well. So that's my short little business story for the night. And now we're going to listen to Michael Abramson's story. Michael, just tell us, where did this all begin? So if you can maybe just take us back to your school years, and did you know that you were going to be a sports commentator? Did you know that you were going to work on cruise ships? Did you know you were going to become a mentalist and all the other things that you do?
David, definitely not. When I was at school, I was extremely shy. People said to me that you're going to, if you're lucky, work in an office environment and hide behind a desk and not have to interact with people. I was very much not a people's person at school. I didn't get involved in too many things. And then gradually, as I started to develop a little bit more confidence, I went into areas that were totally not in my comfort zone. Things like public speaking and getting into broadcasting, because I knew that would force me out of my comfort zone of hiding behind my books and my academics and to try and interact with people. And I started to get into sports broadcasting, started to put some shows together and perform and entertain. But it was never in the thought process at the beginning that we would have a situation where I would be broadcasting on national radio to millions of people around the world, or on television, or presenting mentalism shows. So that was totally outside my comfort zone, but it's something that sort of grew over time. And as you say, I became passionate about and started to invest a lot of time, energy, and effort into making it a success. So it's quite a turnaround from my personality at school.
So how did your personality change that you took it on? What was there a defining moment, or was it just something that happened by chance?
What happened was that I used to sit at home and off the television, I used to record commentaries just for fun into television, into a tape recorder. So what happened was when I was at school and in my early days at university, I used to sit with a tape recorder plugged in and commentate cricket, soccer, rugby, tennis, whatever sport it was, into a tape recorder and record those. And people said to me, "You know, you're quite good at this. Why don't you submit it to the SABC?" So I phoned the SABC. I said, "Would you be interested? Is there a vehicle for me to be able to submit these recordings?" They were on those old cassettes that we used to have growing up, and I submitted them. And they said to me, "You're okay, but there's no real opportunity at the moment." And then we were getting into international sports. It was the early 1990s. And the commentators who were working at the time were going to India on cricket tours and doing various other things, and they had a gap in the Johannesburg Pretoria area for somebody to do local cricket and do local soccer and those sort of things. And they said to me, "Would you like a chance to do this?" And I jumped at the opportunity and I thought, "Wow, this is going to be fantastic." And I didn't have time to think about it because they said to me, I remember I was at the Wanderers, and they said to me, "You're going to do one or two 1 minute reports on a particular provincial game that was taking place." And I thought, "Okay, that's great." And then all of a sudden, all the other venues around the country, it was rain and the games were postponed. And they said to me, "We've got about half an hour free of airtime. We need you to do commentary. Can you do commentary?" And because I didn't have time to think about it, I didn't have time to get nervous or worried. So I just jumped straight into it and did ball by ball commentary for most of that afternoon. And gradually, I became a cricket commentator initially. Then they said to me, "Do you know anything about rugby?" I said, "Not really." They said, "Go learn. We need you to do some rugby for us." And I became a rugby commentator. And then television came to me and said to me, "We need an English voice to do some of our soccer broadcasts on local soccer. What do you know about local soccer?" And I said, "Not very much." They said to me, "Okay, you have a week. Go and learn about the teams, go and learn about the players, and do what you can. We're giving you a game to do in a week's time." And I did that game and it went very well. And I became one of their main soccer commentators. And then I also have a love for gymnastics. So I got involved with the Gymnastics Federation, announcing their events and commentating on some of their stuff. And gradually I expanded to do a whole lot of different sports. And then going to things like the Olympics, where you are forced to cover multiple sporting codes. And you have to educate yourself. You've got to learn about rowing, about archery, about taekwondo, about all these sports that I knew very little about. But it's all part of the process so that you sound credible when you are on air. So it's been quite a long and lengthy, but very, very rewarding journey, and something that I'm very, very privileged to have the opportunity to still do.
And how do you prepare for something like that? How do you prepare for the Olympics where you've got hundreds of different, or not hundreds, but you've got like so many different codes, you've got hundreds of different names and things that you need, and you need to go back and tell people what they did before. How do you prepare for something like that?
It's very difficult. Even preparing for sports that I'm really comfortable with, like soccer or cricket or tennis or rugby, there's a lot of preparation that goes in. People don't realize when I commentate a soccer match, even if it's a local game to small teams that are playing, and I know I'm doing it, let's say it's maybe, I don't know, Durban City against Marumo Gallants, for example, you owe it to the viewers to give them a credible commentary that they can learn something from it. So I sit for hours and hours researching every player. A lot of it I know because obviously, as you've said, I have a good memory and I remember things from the past. I remember what players look like, some facts about them. But I still have to sit down and learn about the players, make notes on how many goals they've scored in the season, which clubs they used to play for, a little bit about their background, how this season has progressed, also the team records, how the team have done, are they on a winning streak or a losing streak, what are the head-to-heads like, all this sort of information. So it takes hours and hours to prepare for a game. And then it's not only the preparation, because you have commentators in this country who can prepare for hours on end, but when they come across, they don't sound credible. So what you have to do is you have to know the laws of the game. You've got to be able to interpret it. You've got to be able to deliver under pressure with a good, clear speaking voice. That's very important, and have credibility, because people need to know that if you say something on air, it's credible. You're not just somebody who has walked into the job, who knows nothing about anything and is trying to sell yourself as a commentator when you don't really have any experience at all. So building credibility, having a good speaking voice, coming across coherently in the language, being able to talk with light and shade, what they call light and shade in the voice. For example, if nothing's happening in a soccer game, you can't make it sound like a hat trick has just been scored. You can't go at 100 miles an hour when nothing's happening, because when something does happen, you've got nowhere to go. So you have to pace yourself. And some of our commentators think that screaming and shouting into a microphone for 90 minutes is good commentary. And I try and educate some of our younger commentators and tell them you've got to pace yourself, so that if something exciting happens, you lift the voice and you lift the energy. But if you, for example, are doing a test match in cricket and a bowler's bowling maiden over after maiden over and nothing is happening in the game, then you need your skills. You've got to tell stories. You've got to find things to talk about. You can't make it sound like it's exciting if it's not exciting. And equally, if it is exciting, you've got to convey that passion. So it is an art. It's a skill like anything else. And all the time, even though I've been doing it for 36 years and I've covered pretty much every World Cups in every major sport, I'm still learning. Every broadcast I do, I learn things, and there are things that I do that I don't like. So I'm constantly trying to improve, even though I've been doing it for years and years and years.
So it reminds me of Charles Fortune, who was the famous commentator, yes, who used to, when nothing was happening, go on and describe the butterflies in the skies. But apparently he used to forget, yeah, that there was a cricket match, and he'd like come back and say, well, there's been three wickets in the meantime.
Correct.
Hopefully you don't do that.
That's a famous story, actually, that he was commentating a test match, and he said something like, England are... I used to be able to do his accent. I grew up sort of imitating Charles Fortune. I don't know if I can still
just
do it.
Try to do it for us.
He would do something like, hello and welcome to the Wanderers, where England is 7 for 4 without loss, and the birds are chirping in the trees, and the butterflies are flying past my commentary box, and it's a lovely day. You've missed three balls. England is 7 for 3. Adcock's hat-trick was the first of his career.
So that's the most important thing.
The accent's gone a little bit. I used to be able to, when I was at school, I used to imitate Charles Fortune commentaries, and people still remember me for that. My schoolmates still say to me, oh, we remember when you used to do Charles Fortune imitations. I'm privileged that I've been able to have a career out of it and still going strong. So let's hope.
Fantastic. And as I said, when I introduced you, that's not the only thing you do. And you alluded to the fact that you've got a good memory. So I want to ask you around the memory and around that whole competition with Pi. But we'll do that after the break. Welcome back. You're listening to the Orchard Business Show. I'm David Zeidel, and we're busy talking to Michael Abramson, and he was talking about his sporting career, and I thought it was fascinating that he said, you've got to prepare, you've got to know your facts, you've got to be appropriate to what's happening. And those things you can apply to business as well. And it's about preparing for business, it's knowing your facts, but even if you're good at what you're doing, finally, you've got to present it in the right way. And then just before the break, you know, Michael, sometimes I will walk into a room, I'll go to the kitchen, and as I get there, I think, why am I actually in this room? You know, somebody said I should buy shoes with memory soles so that I can remember why I walked there. And yeah. Does that ever happen to you? And also then you said that you've got a great memory, and I think a great memory doesn't even describe it, by being able to memorize a number up to 2,000 digits afterwards. Just take us through that.
Okay, so initially on memory, yes. Not often, but it does happen to me that I sometimes think to myself, why am I here? What am I doing? What? I know I walked in here for some reason and I need to trigger something. Memory works with trigger points. So what happens is I use examples on the courses that I teach at schools. I've been privileged to go to 67 schools around the country and teach their learners about how to study for exams, teach business people how to use memory in your day-to-day life, salespeople in terms of how to remember names and faces. And what happens is you need a trigger point. So, for example, let's suppose you're driving in your car and a piece of music plays on the radio. And you hear this piece of music and you think to yourself, oh, I remember that. That last time that song played, I was at this particular venue with this person, and we were discussing this, and all of a sudden all those memories come back into your mind. And they would never have come back if you hadn't heard that piece of music. So that piece of music was a trigger for your brain to say, let me regress my mind back to that situation where I was with this person and I was in this situation and the weather was like this, and you suddenly are thinking back to that experience. So what you need if you want to try and remember something is you need trigger points in your mind. So you if you're writing an exam as a student, you need to remember, okay, here's a keyword in a question. Let me think back. Oh yes, I remember this. I learned it on this day. It was raining outside, and I was looking at this picture on the top left page of my textbook, and all those memories come back to you, and you're able to recall it. So you need to be able to trigger memories in a stressful situation in order to be able to remember. In terms of pi, what happened was I'm a speed cuber. I solved the Rubik's Cube quickly, and I was at a speed cubing competition. That's think it was around about 2017 or 2018, somewhere around there. And one of the competitors whom I was competing against in this big competition said to me, why don't you do the pi challenge? And I said to them, what is the pi challenge? And they said, it's a competition that happens every year. They don't know too much about it. I must look it up, where you remember certain digits of pi. And I investigated it and found out that at the time, the South African record, an African record, was 1,200 digits in half an hour. And I thought to myself, I can certainly sit down and do a lot more than that. But also, I don't want to take hours and hours of time because you need judges who need to sit in. Judges need to verify everything that's happening. You need to make videos. You need to record it. You need to send it overseas for verification. And you can't have somebody sitting there for hours and hours and hours on end waiting for you to recall digits. So I decided I'm going to go for the speed challenge and try and do it as quickly as possible. So initially in 2019, I went for 1,500 digits blindfolded in front of four judges. And I would try to, because I thought to myself that will beat the South African and African record at the time by 300 digits. And also, I'll try and do it as quickly as possible. So I managed to do that in 4 minutes and 7 seconds. And the video of that is on my website. And then COVID came along. And I couldn't do it the next year or the next year because of COVID, and it was just difficult logistically to set up. And then in 2022, as you alluded to, I decided I'm going to try and break my own record by doing an extra 500 digits, so 2,000 digits in total, at a faster speed than I did in 2019, a per digit speed. So I managed to do 2,000 digits in 5 minutes and 12 seconds, which is a speed of almost 7 digits per second. And it's so difficult to do because not only does your brain have to remember entire non-logical sequences of numbers, but you also have to control your breathing so that you have to breathe at certain points. Because if you breathe at the wrong time, your brain gets out of sync with patterns that you've learned in terms of memory. So it is really, really difficult to do. And we managed eventually to get it done. And I was very, very proud of that achievement. And then I sort of let it go for a while. And then on my radio station on SAFM, I decided last year in 2025 that we would do something on World Pi Day. Two schools that I'd worked with very closely, I had their maths teachers and head of academics in studio with me. And I thought I'll just do something quick and easy. So we did the first 200 digits in just over 30 seconds. And that video is also on my website and freely available. But it was just nice to be able to do something that was short and sweet and to the point, and gave people a chance to see what the mind can achieve. I don't think in my own mind that I have a brilliant memory. I just think I have a really trained memory that I have trained to be able to remember all sorts of facts and figures and bits of information that I need. And it is possible, literally, David, for anybody in the world, even school kids as young as 5 and 6 years old to remember facts, to remember whatever they want to remember, to people in their 70s and 80s. I teach bridge players how to remember packs of cards and which cards have been played in bridge games. When I work internationally on cruise ships, I ask people to give me the name of any country in the world, any one of 197 independent countries, and I tell them the flag and the currency and the location and the capital and all these facts that I've stored away in my mind. So provided you put in the effort and you create those trigger points in your brain, you can literally remember anything. But the memory has been a very fascinating journey for me.
So first of all, I want to ask you a little bit around that, but just give us your website address if people want to go to it and look up some of these things.
Okay, so it's PowerBrain, PowerBrain, like brain power, but the other way around, powerbrain.co.za. And I have videos there, I have clips of my broadcasting, some of my highlights of my commentaries over the years, my world records in memory, little mentalism clips, and bits and pieces of everything that I do, because I don't really have a full-time career. I have bits and pieces of all sorts of different avenues of work that I really enjoy. And you spoke about passion earlier, and for me, everything I do, I'm passionate about. And that's why I wake up in the morning looking forward to the day and looking forward to the new challenges because of that passion.
So if I had to ask you now to go and do the pie, would you still remember
yes.
that, or do you have to go and rehearse
100%.
It? 100%. But now how do you...
Yeah, I can...
So you were talking about a student who is busy studying and you've got to link it and hook it to different things. Now, the number pi
yes.
and the reason why it's so unique is that every digit after the 3 point and then it's everything is unique after that. How do you remember those
Correct.
Sequences?
So you have to break it down. For me, I use different patterns. I use different memory systems. So I would sit initially in the early days when I was learning the number and I do 10 digits at a time, 20 digits at a time, then 50 digits at a time, and then go over them and over them and over them, revise them, store them on my phone, listen to it repeatedly, write computer programs where I could type the digits in, say it to myself. Write it down again. So use different parts of the brain, use writing, reading, listening, computer work, and locking those digits in. And once you've locked them in, then you move on to the next lot. It took me, I would say, probably about a week to a week and a half to learn the first 1500 digits of pi and go over them confidently to be able to recite them. And then to get the speed up, you've got to be able to go over it and over and over it. So it becomes almost like driving a car. Comes automatic for your brain. Your brain knows what sequence to go to, and it's just a matter of trying to increase the speed. So what I would do is I would record it on my phone and then play it back. Excuse me. My voice is terrible today. I play it back at a faster speed. So what would happen is I would try and, for example, I'll give you an example. So when I learned it initially, I would go 3.14159265358979323846264, etc. And I would learn it at that speed. And then I would say it over and over and over again, so it becomes almost automatic. And then after a while, you can go 3.14159265358979323846264, and you can go at that speed. And then increase it more and more and more, because your brain sort of knows what digits to say, so it's just a matter of getting the speed up. And eventually, I can do it as fast as I can literally speak, where you can actually hear what I'm saying. And that's a rate of about 6.5 to 7 digits per second. I don't think it's possible physically or materially to go faster than that. So I don't think that record will ever be broken. But it's something I'm very proud of, because it took a lot of time, energy, and effort, and it forced my brain to work under pressure, which I was thrilled about. But it did take many, many many minutes, let's say, to lock it in and to make it work for me. But at least what it does do for me is when I do courses for corporates, for schools, for organizations, I have the credibility, because being introduced as a 3-time memory world record holder gives me credibility. Whereas if I just walked in and started teaching memory skills, people don't know anything about who I am and what I do. So at least it was an investment in potentially building the credibility so that people know that they're in the hands of somebody who has done it and can teach them things.
So I find that astounding. You've actually just answered my next question before I even asked it.
Okay.
And my next question was going to be, what was the benefit of doing all of this? And you've just said it's the credibility. And I think as a business...
It's not only that, it's also testing your brain, making sure that your brain can work under pressure. You need to keep your brain active. Otherwise, brain cells die off every single day. So I do exercises every day for my brain, trying to remember algorithms in a Rubik's cube, trying to remember celebrities that are born on different days of the year. So if somebody, for example, gives me a random date and says the 4th of March or whatever, I can give you a celebrity born on that day. Or I can give you the flag of a country, or I can give you an author of a certain book. Various random facts that comes in well for quizzing in on quiz nights, which is another one of my passions, just remembering random facts or remembering lyrics in Afrikaans songs that I had to listen to prepare for Noot for Noot. So it tests your brain, it keeps your brain active. And once your brain cells are active, then there's no limit to what you can do. So it's also a refresher course for the brain.
Fantastic. And I want to go into how would we, someone else who's not where you are, how would we start practicing that and doing that? But again, we'll do that after the break. Welcome back. You're listening to the Orchard Business Show. I'm David Zeidel, and we're busy listening to Michael Abramson, who has explained a little bit around his sports commentary, around being a mentalist, and around learning facts and trying to keep your mind active all the time. And initially, I said to Michael that, did you do all of this and learn pie just to create the credibility so you can get the work? And you said, no, it's more around just keeping your mind active. So for the rest of us who can't remember pi up to the 200 digits at massive speed, I know some people struggle when people ask them, what's your own phone number? And they can't even remember it. And you make it sound so simple. What can you give us a little bit of what you would do if you came into teaching somebody how to improve their memory? What are some of the things that we could do?
So the first thing that I do on my courses, and I've learned this the hard way over the years by running hundreds and hundreds of courses and seeing how people interact, seeing how people learn, and studying the process. Some people are audio learners, some are visual learners, some prefer tactile situations. So you have to be able to give people techniques that they can take home and make work for them. So the first thing you do is you show people just how incredible the mind actually is. So typically what I would do on my course is I would call out a list of random words, just random objects, and then I would say to people, call them back to me. And inevitably, if I give them a list of 15 or 20 words, inevitably people can remember maybe the first two or three or four, and then one or two random words from later in the list. But they certainly can't remember them in order. And there are a lot of items that they don't even focus on, they don't remember. Because, for example, if I were to give you a list, if I were to say to you table, chair, floor, curtain, window, what you would do is you would focus on the first few. And you wouldn't even listen to those in the middle because you think to yourself, if I start remembering words in the middle, I'm going to forget the words that I learned at the beginning. So you in your head are going over the first two or three. And then I'll say something unusual. For example, I might say helicopter or something that you don't expect me to say. And that will stick in your brain because it's an unusual item. But all the common ones in between, you will gloss over and you won't even remember. You won't even remember that I've called them out to you. So I say to people, okay, show me how many you can call back. And inevitably, the people can call back two or three or four. And then I teach them a technique whereby they can form images in their minds to be able to lock in this information and be able to store it and make it make sense to them. And then after about 10 or 15 minutes, what happens is they can remember the entire list of words, forwards and backwards. And once they've seen that their brain can do that, and it's not just something that I was born with, but they can do it themselves, they buy into the whole concept. And then suddenly I give them another list, a longer list of more items, and they can remember them in order, forwards and backwards. And then I teach them how to remember names and faces of people so that if you meet somebody, you can address them by name rather than trying to think in your mind, where do I know this person from? And that's so important in a sales environment. If you are trying to clinch a sale, you want to be able to address people by name. So in a business environment, particularly, that's really important. Then I teach them facts about how to remember, for example, flags of countries or capitals or bits of information for their studies. And once they've seen that they can do it, they are far more likely to take it on board. And then what I do also on my courses is I teach them what is good for the brain, how many hours of sleep you need a night, what happens to your brain, how your brain refreshes information and stores it. Also, what vitamins you need to be taking in. what minerals you need to be taking in, bad habits that you need to avoid. So we do all of that in a 2.5 hour course. So it's very comprehensive. It's a great investment in people's futures, because what it does is it gives you the tools to be able to use this every day in your life in different avenues, whether you're a student, whether you're an executive of a company, whether you're the CEO or the secretary, whether you are somebody who's just trying to remember names of members at a club that you belong to, or remembering cards in a bridge game, whatever you need memory skills every single day. So this teaches and programs your brain to be able to recall information at will. And as you get better at it, you can learn more advanced techniques. And then I also teach specifically for students things like study skills and exam techniques. So, for example, how to prepare for exams. And I use this based on my own studies when I studied actuarial science, because when I studied actuarial science, there was something like 24, 27 textbooks, I think, of about 500 pages each, of the most mundane material you could ever wish to find. Premium rates in Great Britain and morbidity rates, mortality rates, how pension funds are structured, the most boring stuff. And I had to develop techniques for myself that gave me a competitive advantage. So when I went into a 6-hour exam that I had to write, I needed to be able to recall this information at will, whereas some of my colleagues who were writing might have struggled to retain that information. So I developed techniques for myself, never ever thinking that I would get the opportunity to teach them. But I've had the opportunity now to teach some of these skills, and learners I find buy into it really well. And they often message me to say, oh, we used your technique in this exam and we were able to work out the answer in a multiple choice question, or we were able to pick up marks, or we couldn't finish the paper, but we realized what we needed to do to pick up marks, or which questions to answer first, or what to do if you don't know how to answer a question. So I deal with all those sort of things based on my own experiences. And I teach my own study methods for learning languages, for preparing for mathematics, for learning lots and lots of facts. And I find when students know them, coupled with all the memory skills that they've developed, they have got all the tools that they need to be able to have very successful academic careers. So it's a combination of things that I've learned over the years through trial and error in terms of getting it right, just as you've done in your business, David, in terms of working with people and seeing how people are able to pick up on skills that they develop and how they retain that information. And I've learned from that and done research in terms of how to give people as much as possible in the shortest possible time. And that's why they've been so successful, I think.
And your courses, are they available online, or do you have to come and view them or be at them in person?
I prefer to do them in person because of the personal touch. And when you're working with a group of people and then you have a whole group watching and seeing how some people are responding, it inspires other learners, for example, or other people to see, oh, look, he or she is doing it well, so maybe I can also do it. I like the personal touch. I like the fact that I can be in the same room as a group of other people and interact with them and have their energies working together, and one person inspires the next person. I can do it online, but I find you lose a lot behind a computer screen because you don't have that personal touch, that personal interaction. I can show them demonstrations with the power of the mind in person, which I couldn't show them behind a computer screen. And they're also very reasonably priced. I partially subsidize them as well, so it's not expensive. It's the cost of basically a night out if you go to a restaurant or go and see a theater show. You see the theater show, you get the investment, you get the enjoyment of that particular occasion. The next day you've forgotten about it and you move on with your life and you've got nothing to take out of that. Whereas this, you've got a skill that you can use pretty much for the rest of your life. So I find it's a very, very good investment in somebody's future. I actually had the opportunity when I was younger and I was going for magic lessons as a magician to learn memory skills through somebody who was offering courses. And I thought to myself, this is something that I'd be able to use for the rest of my life, never thinking I would make a career out of it. But that's how it transpired. And I picked up those skills early on and was able to develop my own methods around the methods that I'd already learned to make it work and make it make sense in my brain so that I could teach it to other people. So yes, it's something that I've had a great enjoyment from, and I derive a lot of passion seeing learners and young people especially benefit from the skills that they have and build up their confidence academically and otherwise.
So I normally don't promote the person themselves on screen, but I think it's really valuable that people know where to get this information. And you said your website is it Power Brain?
Ourbrain.co.za. People can message me. I have an email address on the site. they can contact me if they're interested, and we can set things up going forward.
And
But I'm not, I'm, I don't specifically want to promote courses. I've got many, many courses that I'm running at the moment, all over the place, from in different provinces in the country, and I'm keeping pretty busy. The main thing is just for people to believe that they can do it, and not to think, oh, I'm too old, or I'm too young, or I don't have a good memory, or I can't remember things. That's absolute nonsense. You either have a trained or an untrained memory. And once your memory is trained, you can remember anything. I don't care how old you are, unless you've had serious brain injury that impacts you academically or otherwise, and your brain doesn't function correctly. Every single person can learn skills that they can better their memory retention ability by a massive amount.
And it's interesting that you mentioned that you did magic beforehand, because is part of this a magic trick? Is it intellectual magic that you're doing, or is it different to magic? Because, and the reason I'm asking
The
that,
memory component, you
the
mean?
yeah, but
Okay.
the reason I'm asking that is quite a bit on there's a guy called Oz Perlman, I think, who does all these.
Yes,
It's a
Osterman. Yeah.
combination of magic and a combination of mentalism, where he will ask somebody something random and he would have pre-written that down. Now, is that
Yes.
pure magic? Is that just another form of magic? Or is that really a memory skill?
Okay, so it's a difficult question to answer because there are different mentalists around the world. If you go and watch mentalism performances, some mentalists use magic tricks, some mentalists use psychology, some mentalists use probability. I don't generally use magic tricks in my mentalism shows because I have the memory skills that a lot of other mentalists don't have or don't want to learn. I can do things that they probably can't. So I use a lot of genuine memory techniques. I'm also, because of my background in actuarial science and mathematics, I can do very quick mathematical calculations in my head that other mentalists maybe can't do. Where I don't have the skills are areas like sleight of hands. I'm not very dexterous with my fingers. I don't like doing sleight of hand moves or magic moves, where a lot of mentalists would do them because firstly they're good at them and they can get away with it. I don't like doing that. So I use psychology, I use probability, I use body language, I use memory, I use mathematics, I use all those skills in my mentalism shows. But mentalism shows are there for entertainment purposes, to show people what can be done with the power of the mind and to give people an entertaining experience for a corporate function or for a fundraiser or whatever it is, or for a theater show. So people can come along and be wowed by the power of the mind, have a fully interactive experience, and walk out of there thinking, wow, that was quite incredible. If I'm teaching memory skills, I'm teaching purely memory skills. I'm not teaching magic tricks. So these are memory techniques for the brain that allows the neurons between the left and right side of the brain to be developed. It's almost like if it's snowing and you go out with a snowmobile and you clear the road. That's what I do. I clear the pathways in the brain to make it more receptive to obtaining information and storing that information. So once you know how to do it, it is not a magic trick at all. It's a skill, just like any other skill that you would learn. It's a skill that you can use in your day-to-day life, and you can better yourself in all sorts of areas by having the confidence to retain information under pressure.
So is it a way that once I've learned the skill, I've got it? Is it like riding a bicycle? Or is it
Yes.
about riding a bicycle and then learning different tricks on the bicycle so you can never stop learning?
It's a nice way to put it. I think it's once you have the basic techniques, yes, you have those skills and you can use them regularly. But obviously, to remember pi, I can't, for example, remember pi by thinking of each digit and trying to link it to the next digit because there are too many digits and you would go crazy. So I need to use other techniques to be able to remember that. So I use things like memory palaces and phonetic alphabets and various other complicated memory techniques. I'm not going to go into them in great detail here, but I do teach them on advanced memory courses for those who want to learn. But you do need to revise frequently. It is important. If I go away, for example, on holiday for 3 weeks and I don't have a chance to use my memory skills in shows or in presentations or in demonstrations or on courses, then I find when I come back after maybe 3 weeks to a month of not having done it regularly, I'm a little bit slower. It takes my brain a little bit of time to get it to kick in, for example. So I try and practice as regularly as possible. Also, I work a lot with trying to learn languages. I've taught myself to speak Spanish fluently, for example. So I taught myself by watching videos, by reading children's books, learning basic sentence construction. and then using AI to have conversations with every day. I'm brushing up on other things. The moment I'm learning three or four different languages simultaneously and trying to learn some vocabulary basic sentences. So that, for example, when I'm doing soccer commentary, I can say something in Zulu that's relevant to the game. Or if I'm doing a talk on a cruise ship, I can talk to somebody in a language that's they maybe know better than English and resonate with them. So it's you use these skills all the time. I'm learning a little bit of Russian at the moment. Russian is a very difficult language to learn because the characters are so different, the sounds are very different, and the sentence construction is different. I'm brushing up on my Zulu again. I'm revising my Hebrew from school. I mean, it's all there in my brain, but I haven't spoken it for ages. So I'm going over that and over that and over that, learning a little bit of Japanese and a bit of other languages just to have those skills to be able to greet people and say a few words to them in their native language, because that's how you build rapport with people. So you can use these skills in pretty much every avenue of life.
And you mentioned AI. Do you have a belief around AI that maybe it is dumbing us down, that we're relying so much on AI that we don't even have to remember the facts?
Absolutely. And I find that happens a lot with spelling, for example. School kids don't know how to spell because when I was at school, I had to write things down. I had to learn spelling of words. Nowadays, you have predictive text. You have AI that can generate documents for you, that can do all sorts of things. So your brain doesn't get used to seeing how words are spelt on a page, or learning sentence construction, learning meanings of words. Everything is sort of done for you and your brain becomes lazy. And as powerful as your brain is very lazy. If you don't have to remember something, your brain will not remember it. For example, when I was growing up, I used to memorize people's phone numbers and know the phone numbers off by heart. So if I was phoning a friend, I knew the number to dial. Nowadays, you don't need to do that. You've got it stored in your phone. You've got all that information. So most of the times, if I were to say to you, what is the number of somebody, maybe a colleague of yours, you probably wouldn't remember it. You wouldn't need to remember it because it's in your phone and you just dial the person's number. Whereas in the old days, you couldn't do that. So I find that by being lazy, what you're doing is you are giving your brain an excuse not to have to remember things. So those are techniques that I find AI and particularly and predictive text and all the stuff that we have at the moment at our disposal is making us lazy and making our brains lazy. So our brains don't work as well as they could. And it's also affecting, I think, relationships because people are being able to have meetings behind screens. They can hide behind certain personality situations. They don't have to put themselves out there and expose themselves in a public situation. I mean, in the old days, before COVID, you didn't have meetings behind computer screens. Now we're having a lot of meetings behind computer screens. So you're having, we're dealing with a completely different world. And I think our brains are battling to adapt to that. So when we are put into certain situations, we're not as good as people would have been in the past because we don't have that experience. So I definitely find AI has an effect on how studying is done, on how learners learn things and how people pick up information.
And if we go back to just the cruise liner, I actually want to ask you two things. One is around the cruise liners. What do you do when you go onto the cruise liner? Mm-hmm. And the second thing is just overall, you've shared quite a lot about developing the brain. Do you have some life lessons that you would tell people that according to the life lessons of Michael Abramson, what should people focus on? But we'll do that after the break. Welcome back. You're listening to the Orchard Business Show. I'm David Zeidel, and we're busy talking to Michael Abramson, and he's sharing these fascinating stories around just using your brain and training your brain. So, Michael, just two quick questions. The one is, when you go on, and you mentioned you go into cruise liners and you do shows, what exactly do you do there? And how do you get, do you stay on a cruise liner for the whole trip or do they move you around and how do you do that? And then also your tips of life lessons for maybe the youngsters or, as you say, our brain's always growing. So maybe even the older people, what are some of your life lessons that you'd like to share with us?
Okay, perfect. So first up on cruise ships, well, I like cruising as a passenger, as a guest, and have been on many, many, many different cruises around the world. I just love it. I find it's really convenient. You put your stuff into a room and you don't have to pack and unpack and move from hotel to hotel every day. food is freely available, entertainment's available, sporting options are available. You get to see many, many places around the world. I've been fortunate to go to 60 different countries around the world and many more in the pipeline. So I really love it. And because they know that I'm an entertainer and somebody who can make a difference for the experiences of guests on a cruise ship, if I get booked on a contract, I would typically get flown to the port where you embark and then go on as an entertainer. I would still have guest privileges, but I would have to perform my mentalism show, well, two shows actually, on different nights, the same show twice for two different audiences, depending on when they have their dinner, and then another brand new show performed twice later on in the cruise so that people can get to see your first show and your second show. And then what I also do is in between, I try and offer them a memory lecture where I would talk to the guests for an hour or so, explain to them how memory works, teach them a few skills, which is basically what I do here for corporate clients or what I do in my courses, and show them a few memory demonstrations. For example, I can memorize an entire shuffled pack of cards in about 10 to 15 seconds. So I would show them how I do that. I would ask them to call out countries and tell them information about countries or bits of information that they want me to recall. I would do my pi challenge. So I would say to them, here, Google the first, say, 200 digits of pi on your phone, and let me call it out to you. So it's a fun demonstration on memory. It makes them buy in and it makes them want to learn more about memory. And I would typically stay on the cruise for, I don't know, 5 days, 6 days, a week. And then when the cruise docks, they would either fly me to a different port to go on another boat, or I would fly home. Or if it's close to South Africa, then it's even more convenient. And that's how it works. I have agents internationally who book me on international cruise ships. So it's fun. I enjoy it. I basically have a holiday, but I also get a lot of time to interact with people. In terms of life lessons, and the lesson that I've learned is to be passionate about what you do. If you don't enjoy what you're doing, you don't have the motivation to get up in the morning and to start your day. I've had many, many disappointments in my life. I've had people promise me all sorts of things. It still happens. People make all sorts of promises to me because they're trying to get something out of me as soon as possible. Once they have what they need, they switch off and they sort of ignore you. And that's something that I've learned. And I've learned to put that behind me and to be passionate about what I do, to make every interaction with every person, no matter what it is, whether it's a student who comes on my courses or somebody who comes to me for extra lessons or an audience member who's in doing my show, who's in the audience in my show, whether they're participating actively or not, or if it's a listener or a viewer on television or radio who is listening to my radio show or listening to a broadcast where I'm commentating, you want to try and give them a memorable experience that they remember, okay, that was really pleasant for me. I learned something. It was educational. So passion is really important. If you have the passion and you know that you are making a positive difference to people's lives, that is the most important thing. I think it was Mother Teresa who said, you must always leave people when they walk away from an interaction with you, feeling as if they've improved or feel as if you've made their life better, even if it's just for a short while. So I love to create, for example, opportunities for young people. I have a lot of people who job shadow me, who come and sit in on studio when I'm doing my show. On my radio show, I promote young people, particularly sporting talents. I try and have them in studio so I can give them a platform to be able to talk. I do a lot of interviews with actors and actresses in the media industry to give young people an opportunity to showcase their talents. And I find that that is really important. If you can make a difference for people, people will remember that and they will remember the positive interactions that they've had with you. And hopefully it'll open doors for them just in the same way that certain people in my past have opened doors for me. So I think be passionate, be committed in what you're doing, be sincere and be genuine and literally want to make an improvement and don't always make it a tit for tat situation that if you do something nice for me, I'll do something nice for you. Just be freely giving, because the world and the universe will give back to you in so many different ways. And I've been so privileged to have so many opportunities in my life that I still have at this moment. And I'm still fortunate enough that I'm in good health. I'm able to continue to do what I love doing and make a difference in so many people's lives. So that to me is my biggest life lesson. Make a difference and don't worry about what the benefits are to you. Just go out there, freely give of yourself, and people will remember what you've done and it will give them an opportunity to make a difference to other people in their lives. So that would be my message.
Wow, that's incredible. So I just want to sum up a little bit of what I've taken from what you've said. So you said, first of all, obviously, have passion in what you're doing, be committed, but do it genuinely. And make every interaction memorable and leave people improved, that they leave a better person than when they came into the interaction. And correct. Michael, thank you very much. I know you teach memory skills, and you've improved my memory by just talking to this, because I'm going to remember this interview for a very, very long time. Thank you so much. I'm David Zeidel, and this has been the Orchard Business Show.